Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Well, good afternoon. This is Alan Phillips, attorney at law, co-host with Debbie Brock from Homeopathy World Community. Every Thursday at noon Eastern Time in the U.S., we have Vaccines and Your Rights. Debbie is going to be joining us perhaps a little bit late today, so I'll go ahead and get started, I think, without her. Hopefully, she'll be with us shortly. And we have the chat line is now open online at blog.radio.com for Homeopathy World Community. And I see we have at least one or two people logged in there in the chat. Thank you for joining us today. Okay, we're going to... Pardon me, I'm checking for notes here. We're going to dive right into some subjects. Oftentimes on the Thursday Vaccine and Your Rights show, we talk about some vaccine-related news items that occur currently and recently, and a lot of the news items come directly from articles that are posted at the pandemicresponseproject.com. Website, that pandemicresponseproject.com. The top of every page on that site is a list of links, and the far right link is a news link. So we're going to be drawing from some of the recent articles posted at the news page of the Pandemic Response Project today. I'd like to get started first with just a little bit of a update. Last week we talked in part a lot about the Gardasil vaccine and about how that is now being recommended for boys and young men in addition to girls and young women. We had an article in the Herald Sun down in Australia that announced a class action lawsuit or possible class action lawsuit over Gardasil vaccine adverse events. This from right at the end of October. This article talks about how a Melbourne woman who suffered an autoimmune and neurological attack, that's the phrase they use, after getting the Gardasil vaccine, is leading a class action suit against the manufacturer. Apparently, there are seven other Australian women who are considering joining the case against Merck, and they say they've suffered serious adverse events, anaphylaxis, and physical breakdowns as a result of the vaccine, and one attributed a miscarriage to the injections. And I have to tell you, it always, it saddens me to hear about any vaccine adverse events, but it is problematic for me even more so many times when I hear about pregnant women getting vaccines, especially any vaccine that could not be associated with an immediate risk of some sort of impending harm. There's been very little to no research that I'm aware of that's been done on the effect of vaccines in pregnant women on the fetus. And you can look at package inserts. In fact, I had a healthcare worker tell me recently that she was pregnant and had asked the hospital for an exemption to the required flu shot that hospitals around the country here in the U.S. are now requiring of healthcare workers because she was pregnant. And she was quite surprised to see the hospital refuse her request based on her status of being pregnant. And even though, and this particular worker had gone out and looked up and read the package insert of the particular vaccine they were requiring the employees to get, and on the package insert, and this is common probably with many, if not most, vaccines, where the package insert says that they don't know the potential effects of the vaccine on the fetus when injected into pregnant women. And so how a hospital can take that uncertainty and so casually dismiss it and require a pregnant employee to get the vaccine is, to me, mind-boggling. And I mean, I think even a mainstream pro-vaccine person would have difficulty brushing that aside. So it's real difficult to understand how employers can do that. In any event, apparently there's a group of women now who are looking at a class action lawsuit in Australia. Now, we don't have that option really here in the U.S. The vaccine manufacturers have almost absolute immunity from the adverse effects caused by their vaccines, and the recourse, when you have recourse at all, is with the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, a federal program. And apparently some states also have a state-level vaccine injury compensation programs. I know they have one here in North Carolina. I haven't explored that in any depth, so I'm not quite sure how that system works. I think maybe it's an option after you've gone through the federal program. I'm not quite, again, quite sure how that works. But only in very rare situations and circumstances will somebody have the option after trying to go through the vaccine injury compensation program of going to state court with their concerns. So it's very limited. So it's interesting to see that in other countries they have a different approach. They can go to court, and in this case, potentially a class action lawsuit with a small group of affected women in Australia. And again, hopefully our usual co-host for the show, Debbie Brook of Homeopathy World Community, will be with us hopefully shortly. We'll move on to another article. We found out, I saw a few, if not several, different articles referring recently to the fact that federal advisors here in the United States are endorsing testing of the anthrax vaccine in children. This is raising quite a controversy even among pro-vaccine advocates. But we had a panel of government advisors who, about a week ago, gave their okay, gave their recommendation to proceed with a controversial study to test the anthrax vaccine in children to see whether or not it would protect children against a hypothetical future bioterrorist attack. The National Biodefense Science Board, NBSB, advises the federal government on issues related to bioterrorism. They voted 12-1 to recommend that the Department of Health and Human Services move forward with a study aimed at determining whether the vaccine is safe and effective in children. and to identify the best dose. And there was only one dissenter on that panel of 13. People have been quick to speak out against this. And here's one panel member, Ruth Berkelman from Emory University, says, "We need to know more about the safety and the immunogenicity of the vaccine as we develop plans to use the vaccine on a large number of children in the event of a bioterrorist attack." Nonetheless, at the end of the day, after sifting through the scientific and social and ethical concerns raised by this issue, an 8-member working group concluded that it would be ethically justifiable to conduct
hey,
a study.
Alan,
yes.
I finally was able to call in, talking with the technicians back in the back of the Blog Talk Radio to help me out with the technical issues today. Can you just like give me a quick summary? Where are you? What are you talking about right now?
I'm talking about the federal recommendation and federal advisors endorsing the testing of the anthrax vaccine. And welcome, Debbie. Very
okay.
glad to have you here. Felt very cold and alone without you, so glad to have you. Glad
you know,
to have
really,
you in with us now.
It's really hard to do a show solo. I can tell you that for sure. So it's better to have a couple of voices and conversation, banter back and forth, and, you know, it takes you to different places that you didn't think you would go. So you're talking about the federal advisor's endorsement of testing anthrax vaccine in children.
Yep, that's where we are today.
Okay.
At this point. And so I was just saying that after sifting through the scientific, social, and ethical issues raised by the question, an 8-member working group concluded that it would be ethically justifiable to conduct a study which would provide crucial information, such as whether the vaccine is safe. I guess if some kids die or mm-hmm. become disabled, they'll have an answer to that.
Have they tested? I don't know the background of this in particular. Have they tested in animals? Have they tested in cells in just petri dishes? What have they done? At what stage of their development are they in this testing?
Well, I don't know. It's not clear from what I've read so far whether they're talking about something different than the anthrax vaccine that's already been injected into millions of military personnel or not. It sounds, from what I'm seeing so far, that they're talking about the same vaccine, although they're going to be testing for doses and levels in children. But as far as I can tell so far, it'd be the same vaccine that has already gone through whatever testing it has, but nonetheless, that has been injected into military personnel. Of course, as you know, Debbie, the use of the anthrax vaccine in military personnel has raised many serious questions and great controversy, downplayed, of course, by the military and the federal government, but a lot of questions about whether Gulf War syndrome is caused by or has a relationship to the anthrax vaccine, and some compelling information to suggest that there is a relationship. So I don't know if I don't know enough about the medical part of all of this to know how, if or how additional kinds of non-human testing might be appropriate or called for here. I mean, the idea of
PETA would be up in arms to think that little animals would be tested, and so to think that we were going to do this to children, and we've already got consequences in the soldiers who have been vaccinated for this. I would have to do a little bit of in-depth research to find out precisely what the consequences are of this vaccine. But, you know, why are we doing this in the first place? What is the rationale behind this? What are the people afraid of? Is this so great an issue beyond other issues, social issues that we have of poverty and lack of nutrition and these kinds of things? Why would the government endorse such a proposal?
Well, of course, the cynical response is because it's profitable to the vaccine industry that is pulling the strings of those making decisions in the government. But on the surface, I believe the argument is going to go something along the lines of, well, if there's a bioterrorist attack, we're going to need to protect large numbers of children, inject them with vaccines. We need to know we have a safe vaccine to do that with, or an effective vaccine.
So they're preparing for some sort of bioterroristic war, and don't we have better things to worry about?
Well, and I'd love to answer that question in some detail, because there's another article also linked from the news page of the Pandemic Response Project .com site, where a pro-vaccine person takes a view against this idea of testing the anthrax vaccine in children. And I oftentimes deliberately present, I'll put it like this, I do not make an effort on the information that I post to give a complete and balanced representation of pro-vaccine and anti-vaccine points of view. I feel that the pro-vaccine point of view is well entrenched and established in our culture and society, and that what we need is a focus on the other side, not even necessarily so much to flip the pendulum to the other side or flip the coin to the other side, so to speak, in terms of policy and law, so much as to validate the fact that there is an absolutely valid and legitimate opposing view to current policy and law. And
right,
so
we
that
need
while,
a balance, yeah.
Well,
But
my point is I don't try to provide that balance. We need a balance, but I provide the other side that gets very little attention for the purpose of endorsing a right to choose ultimately, not over the short term, for the purpose of trying to say, look at both sides and can't you see one side or the other is right.
I'm thinking of the ultimate legal law symbol of the weights and balances, and what you're seeing is one side is down to the ground getting all the media news attention and research publications, and the other side is way up there not getting anything hardly, except for the people like Barbara Lowe Fisher who are shouting to the rooftops, and that's just one tiny voice. So you're saying let's put some more weights of gold coins onto the other side and create a balance so people do have the right to choose equally.
Right. Well, and underlying this idea from my point of view is that while ultimately, of course, I want the disputed facts to be resolved to the extent that they can, but in the meantime, the fact that there are opposing views that are legitimate opposing views, depending on how you define legitimate, of course, but that in the worst-case scenario for either side, there are opposing views, and therefore we as individuals should have the right to make up our minds with the healthcare practitioners of our choice, or even on our own if we desire, and not have our government tell us what side to pick, because anytime government gets into it, then you necessarily have the issue of who is influencing government, how, in what way, and to what degree, and can government really make ultimately objective decisions when it's being pressured by people who have an interest in the answer being one side or the other. But the long-winded way of saying, I don't ordinarily post articles like the one here from somebody who's pro-vaccine, but he's a pro-vaccine person making some really good points about why we should not be testing the anthrax vaccine on children. And I wanted to walk through this article and discuss some of these points today, because there's some really good ones.
Okay, so we want to emphasize that this show is about the law, your rights to make a decision for yourself or your family members, whether you're a parent or a guardian, whether you're in the military, whether you're an immigrant coming into the country, that you should have a right to make a decision about your body And that is the legal issues. We're really not delving into the medical issues when we talk in this show. The other thing that I'm thinking here is, because you're testing in children, who has the right to make them a guinea pig? I can understand if you're 18 and you're of legal age, then you have a right to say, okay, I want to go in for this this experimental program and be tested and let them figure out what it does for the immune response. But to do it in children is a whole nother ball game. So you want to go point by point on this particular article?
I do, and I think we can do so with an efficient use of our time today and hopefully not spend the rest of the show doing that. But there are such good points, and again, they're coming from a pro-vaccine person, and that's why this article and these points really stand out. It makes a really good case here. I presume, by the way, that parents would have to give permission for the children to participate in medical research of this nature, and that raises a real interesting question of, you know, what parents would do that. But there's some real interesting points here. The first thing this guy says is, and let me give the gentleman credit, Steven Salzberg. He's a contributing writer to Forbes. And so we're on here. So he starts with, he says, for starters, anthrax is not infectious. There's we're not talking about a hypothetical anthrax outbreak. Because this is not, anthrax is caused by a bacteria, or by bacteria, and this is not a bacteria that, bacterium that can spread from person to person, such as measles, mumps, and flu, and so forth. He goes on to say, anthrax was never a public health threat, and it isn't one now. And he goes so far as to say that by developing and promoting an anthrax vaccine, which he says we don't need at all, the government is abusing the goodwill of the public and possibly endangering public health further by playing into the hands of the anti-vaccine movement. Again, just to underscore, this is not somebody out of the anti-vaccine community, or if he is, he's very well disguising that.
Right.
But that's sort of an interesting point.
So he's kind of seeing a rebound effect for giving stockpiling information that would actually help the anti-vaccine coalition.
He sees this idea of going just the having the money invested into the research and development of anthrax vaccines, because it's not something that spreads from person to person, as something that actually furthers the anti-vaccine movement, which he apparently would prefer the government not do. He says, he points out that the CDC does not recommend that children be vaccinated against anthrax. In fact, it doesn't recommend that anyone get routine vaccination against anthrax. And then he has a quote here in this article, vaccination is recommended only for those at high risk, such as workers in research laboratories that handle anthrax vaccine, anthrax bacteria routinely. And he supports the CDC recommendation. So he was, as he says here in his article, stunned to learn that the National Biodefense Science Board was recommending this. In the board's own report, they admit that currently U.S. children are not at immediate risk from anthrax and would not benefit directly from pre-event vaccine, anthrax vaccine administration.
What does that mean? What does that mean? What
would not benefit? In other words, if there's not an actual occurring anthrax attack, there's no benefit for a bioterrorist attack. There's no benefit from giving children an anthrax vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the board also states that there's no known benefit to vaccinating children in the absence of an imminent threat from exposure to the vaccine. I mean, part of this has to do, and he points this out in the article, part of this has to do with the fact that if there is some immediate exposure, current exposure or risk of exposure, the response there is antibiotics. It's not a vaccine. And the presumed long-term risk is that anthrax spores can survive quite a lengthy time under hard conditions. So the risk of exposure to spores may be some extensive period of time beyond the immediate release of them. So, but
the other question that somebody might ask is, you know, you're doing this testing of anthrax on children, and we know that very often vaccinations do not have a long-term effect, that you have to have boosters, that they don't provide complete immunity, that they don't last for a decade, you know, maybe only a couple of years. So that would indicate that you would have to continually get vaccinated. I mean, it seems like it's more of just a way for the people who are developing the vaccines to experiment as to what happens when somebody gets vaccinated, or, you know, what the effects are, without really taking into consideration the people who you're injecting.
Well, this was part, you know, presumably part of the reason for the need to test this on children, so they can find out how many doses does it take to get a response, how long does the response last, you know, how do you need booster shots, and if so, when and how often. And presumably these are the sorts of things they'd be wanting to test for and find out. But the author in this article points out that the board has said preparation for national and potentially global threat from the use of this particular strain of anthrax spores by terrorists is a major priority for U.S. national security. And the writer says this is a massive overstatement. The board, the NBSB, the board knows that anthrax is not infectious, and the only people affected in an attack would be those directly exposed to the bacteria, and likely a handful of people. So we don't vaccinate millions of people just to protect a hypothetical few. Well, I'm not sure. I think maybe we do already do that to some extent, but his point is well made with the anthrax vaccine in that it's not infectious. Of course, these are arguments that might hold up as well for something like HPV vaccines, which are also not infectious, at least not in the sense that, you know, measles and flu and such
things. Yeah, you have to have sexual contact for
non-casual contact. You know, yeah. You know, the sort of casual contact that
it's not going to spread rapidly in that way.
Right. Right.
Right. It's person to person.
Right. So this writer says, why are we wasting billions of dollars to develop, test, and administer a vaccine against something that hardly infects anyone? And I'm sure there's a whole list of other questions that I don't have the answer to concerning the likelihood that a strain that would be used as a bioterrorist weapon is one that a vaccine would necessarily protect against in the first place. In the same sense, and we'll have to find a medical person to weigh in on this if we can, but in the same sense that they have to guess at what the dominant strains of the flu are going to be every year, and they so that they can make a vaccine that will hopefully protect against it. And if they guess the wrong strain, which happens a good deal of the time, the flu shot you get, even if it is perfectly safe and completely effective, may be useless because it may be that the strain or strains that it's designed to protect against turn out not to be the ones that are the dominant strains in the season that particular shot is being widely administered. So There's a separate question there that I'm not seeing addressed in these articles, that even if the vaccine does turn out to be safe and effective, what is the likelihood that any particular strain, I mean, if there's a way to, in the laboratory, devise strains that will beat the vaccine, if you will, surely they'll be trying to do that. Surely it's reasonably easy to get a hold of vaccines, especially when the government has already stockpiled billions of dollars worth of anthrax vaccines. Probably wouldn't be too hard to get a hold of that.
They have done that. They have done that. They have stockpiled billions of dollars worth of anthrax vaccines.
Let me see if I can find the figures quoted here. I know here's one part of the article.
The reason I ask is I recall last year, the year before, there were so many vaccines and they get outdated and then they have to throw them away or else use them up.
Well, and that varies from, you know, the shelf life of vaccines. I mean, we saw with the pandemic flu vaccines, the swine flu vaccines, that depending on which manufacturer and which manufacturing method was used, that some of them did expire after only a few months and others had a shelf life for much longer. So it's absolutely a valid question. I don't know what that is with regard to the anthrax vaccines, but here in this Forbes article, the government announced Project BioShield in 2004, which dedicated $5.6 billion to biodefense, and he says much of that went to anthrax vaccine research. Let me see, because I know I saw a reference in the article somewhere here. I'll see if I can, if I find it, I'll quote you on it. But I do recall seeing information saying that yes, we had spent substantial sums of money. I think it was a couple of billion dollars for the stockpiling of anthrax vaccines. But it's absolutely a good question. You know, what's the shelf life? And from the point of view of a manufacturer, well, we could be attacked any time, so we need to have these vaccines stockpiled. And wouldn't it be, you know, wonderful whether or not they're used if any that are left expired and we can make a whole new batches and sell them over and over again to the government, whether they ever use them or not, because of vaccine expiration dates attached to it. So it's absolutely a good question. We'll have to get more information and come back with that.
Okay. So was there anything else that this gentleman was talking about, this pro-vaccine individual who is concerned about the development of testing anthrax vaccines in children? He doesn't find this to be a good direction for the government to take. What else did he say that you think we could look at in a legal, lawful point of view?
Well, he brings out an interesting, couple interesting points here near the end of the article. He says he's not surprised if the government dedicates billions to biodefense and distributes it to companies and universities who will then become dependent on these funds. Then advisory panels such as the NBSB that we've been talking about will recommend an ever-increasing number of security measures because some of the members of that committee are funded by biodefense dollars. And if we cut the funding, their own livelihoods might suffer. This is a real interesting and I think ongoing problem throughout healthcare and other areas of government as well, or where government is involved, or even in people in industry. I mean, we have, you know, people refer, for example, to the multi-billion-dollar cancer industry, and all people with an alternative view of cancer and cancer treatment will sometimes point out that their belief, and there's information to support this, that there are perhaps many different cures and potential cures for cancer that never get any kind of mainstream press or any real attention, or that are actively attacked by federal agencies, state and federal agencies, because there is developed over the last three or four decades, at least at this point, a firmly entrenched cancer industry, cancer research industry. And if we actually cured cancer, an entire industry would diminish profoundly. Okay, no need to keep spending dollars on research. We have the answer, or we can certainly minimize or narrow the focus of research. So there are conflicting interests where on the surface we give this face of looking for genuine cures, genuine protection, genuine support of health in one way or another. And yet there are people whose very livelihoods are threatened by success. And so it creates this tremendous resistance to hearing about success or promoting any success that might be a threat to that industry.
Right, because we have reverse reward. Instead of rewarding the physician, paying them when the patient is well, we pay them when they're sick. And it's kind of reverse psychology, reverse feedback, but maybe, you know, in the same way of this type of industry where the drug market and the vaccination industry, all of that, they get paid for building it instead of, you know, paid to see that people are actually healthy.
I heard a wonderful firsthand story on a radio show a few years ago about an ethnobotanist who was down studying an Aboriginal culture and their approach to healthcare, and I believe in somewhere in South America, it was probably a South American rainforest. And he spent an extended period of time and interacting a lot with a local shaman figure in this Aboriginal community. And at some point, the American ethnobotanist himself got sick and ended up asking the shaman to help him. And at some point he's saying, "How much do I owe you, you know, for your help?" And the shaman's response was, "Well, I haven't cured you yet."
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was fascinating. You know, it's like that. So it's actually possible, at least in some small pockets of the world today, to have a system where you're paid by your success and not by the repeated attempts to deal with it. Because, of course, if you get paid for your involvement, you're going to want to directly or indirectly find ways to extend your involvement.
Right. You want to add on, if you go to get your car repaired, it was to say, if you go to do that and you can keep finding things wrong to keep fixing, then you keep getting paid. Rather than, you know, it's like a protective policy. Some people do that with insurance, don't they? let's say for the legal services, they have a plan where they hire somebody to pay monthly or annually, and then if anything goes wrong, they're covered. I don't know
right.
if that's the same thing, but. That way, the person wants to make sure that they're well, I think.
Well,
I might be wrong.
As a society and culture, we try to minimize and downplay risk, which is something that's, to one degree or another, inherent in being alive. The insurance industry is certainly a huge measure of that, I guess you could say, the extents will go. Of course, it makes sense to, from at least one point of view.
I think I took us on a very dangerous path because I'm not thrilled with the insurance industry. But the main issue for all of the things that we talk about is the concept of security, the concept of hitting our emotions, our fears, that are we going to be safe? Are we going to be healthy? So we're going to provide these protective supposedly tools or benefits to you to provide vaccinations against some potential threat. And unfortunately, the harm that is done from those many vaccines is we haven't even counted it. It's so great. And the question is, how do we undo this direction? So here this person is telling us all of these potential bioterrorist attacks are not even communicable diseases, and it's only going to affect a small portion of society. And why should we do a blanket statement of injecting so many people or even testing little children? So that's really what we're talking about. And were there any other items that this gentleman spoke about that were pertinent?
Well, that, and it's just that there was a panel member, Ruth Berkelman, who I mentioned earlier, says, and she's speaking to the Washington Post, says we need to know more about the safety and testing of the vaccines as we develop plans to use the vaccines on a large number of children in the event of a bioterrorist attack. And this writer says, no, we don't. We don't need to know about the safety of the vaccine in children because it would be unethical to test it on them. And if there is an attack, we shouldn't respond by vaccinating, quote, a large number of children, unquote, because anthrax doesn't spread from person to person. This is one vaccine we can do without. And I tell you, hearing that from somebody who starts this article by saying how wonderful vaccines are, with the classic mainstream misinformation about all the diseases that vaccines have controlled and eliminated and so forth, it comes as a very strong statement coming right out of the pro-vaccine community itself, and a very thoughtful argument against not even just the testing of anthrax vaccine on children, which he calls unethical for very good reasons, but actually against the anthrax vaccine at all. How many more things could we be spending these billions of dollars on where we could make some real difference right now for present problems, present issues? It's not that protecting against hypothetical future problems in and of itself is bad or wrong, but we have to make decisions. And as I think you were pointing out, Debbie, these decisions are not always rationally based. They're often fear-based. And whether that's a deliberate manipulation from someone who stands to profit or otherwise benefit or achieve an unstated goal, you know, is something we could explore with regard to any given decision. But we see a lot, of course, conflict of interest and conflicting information in the vaccine controversy generally. But it sure seems like each vaccine, to one degree or another, is its own story, its own case, its own discussion. And here with the anthrax, just many, many differences between it and most of the other diseases and vaccines that really sets it apart, even for some people in the pro-vaccine community. So I think that's a strong, strong finishing statement by this writer.
Right. Very, very good. I agree with you on that. And it's important that people hear this information so that it is, in a form, a checks and balances, that people know what government or business and industry are attempting to do, so that everybody can have a say and talk about it in the public eye, which is really, really important. So do we want to talk about the ethics of studying a strain replacement by vaccinating adults with PCV7 in Africa?
Yes, let's move right on to that one. This is
And I want to make one more comment, that when we have this show each Thursday at noon Eastern time, we are talking to people who are very interested and passionate about these issues, this is our opinion. This is not for replacing any medical or legal advice. Are you there?
Yep, yep.
Okay, okay. I just wanted to make that comment so that people understand what we're doing on the show.
Okay. This comes from an article published online by the Public Library of Science, PLOS, PLOS, PLOS. I don't know if they have a specific pronunciation for that, PLOSmedicine.com. The title of this article is Ethics of Studying Strain Replacement by Vaccinating Adults with PCV7 in Africa, as you just said, Debbie. The study, the article points out that the study raises some ethical concerns, and it's sort of it's one I think it's worthy of our scrutiny. The PCV7 is a vaccine for infants, first of all. It is apparently there's research showing that it reduces the incidence of the vaccine strain of pneumococcal disease in both vaccinated babies and in non-vaccinated older persons, presumably because it limits the with regard to the older people, it limits their exposure by way of protecting the infants. I guess that's the rationale there. However, studies have also shown that vaccine use results in strain shifts over a period of 4 to 6 years. And so what happens is that after you use the vaccine, a few years later, you have new strains of the same disease that are different from the vaccine strain. And these new strains are known to be less penicillin sensitive than the strains prevalent in the community before vaccination. And the article says, and so they're more expensive to treat. And maybe more difficult to treat as well, which they didn't happen to also say in this article, it just said it's more expensive to treat. So the study that this article is criticizing, this PCV7 was given in a what they call a cluster randomized trial, but the bottom line here, this was to adults. The vaccine was given to adults, and the vaccine is not intended for adults. And thus, the experiment's been shown or done on a group of people who are not expected to benefit from it. Nevertheless, by administering this vaccine, they are creating the very real possibility, based on the previous research, that over a period of a few years, the prevalent strain of this particular bacterium is going to be, will change, could very likely change. And this was done in Gambia. It's a poor country where villagers may not easily afford antibiotics in the first place. And so they're saying, the authors of this study, of this article are saying, we wonder if it was correct to subject this population to such selection pressure. And I believe that refers to the potential for strain change that could have resulted in the spread of penicillin-resistant pneumococcal disease in the community.
Mm-hmm. So this is MRSA, really. I mean, it's resistant antibiotics, resistant strains of bacteria to antibiotics that are curative. Now, although they are less than they have been over the past 30 years. So what we're doing is we're manipulating the health environment of cultures, of societies, by injecting them. And is that ethical to do that, to actually push the natural strains of disease to become more and more resistant to things that we do have, the antibiotics right now, which are not so effective as they used to be? We're humanity. We're the ones who are moving it in a very dangerous direction. So the question is this ethical, and has it already been done? Does this article state that this study has already been done?
Yes. The article starts out saying that the study was meticulously planned and well executed. However, mm-hmm. it raises the following ethical concerns and goes on. So this has already taken place.
Question is, should it ever be done again? Really, this is the question that's being raised, that this was done, these are the results, we see this, and should we be doing this ever again?
Right, and here's a couple of points, about the study. So for one thing, they said that the village, they had community consent from the villages involved, and even some consent from individuals.
Mm-hmm.
People
in the community themselves. What about the local government or the government, the African government itself?
Well, they had consent, but there are article authors say we wonder if informed consent included disclosure of the study's aim to look for strain shifts and an increase in resistant bacteria. So they were supposedly looking for those things. And the question is it ethical to do a study where you know from prior studies that this could create a health problem for the community that you're researching? Now, mm-hmm. another point here is that the study was limited to 2 years instead of the 4 to 6 years required for that sometimes pass when you see the strain change occur. They said instead of the 4 to 6 years required for full replacement, that's the language they use. And yet the authors mm-hmm. conclude that the vaccine does not increase non-vaccine strains, which is rather disturbing. It's like if a strain change occurs typically in 4 to 6 years, well, let's just do a 2-year study and then the vaccine will look good. Now, I've heard about this same technique generally, that pharmaceutical companies will sometimes do their own internal research. They see an adverse effect show up, 6 weeks down the road, then they'll have a university do a 4-week study, and then after 4 weeks, yep, it's safe, nothing happens. And I've heard anecdotally of that this is something that goes on within the industry. And here now we have a rather more formally documented instance of it, where there's a problem in 4 to 6 years, so let's just do a 2-year study and then we can have a positive
result. But what we really should be concerned about many more years than 2 years. We need to be looking at 10, 20, 30 years, because we know that vaccinations, the adjuvants, the heavy metals, the chemicals that are in them are toxic to the human body, which the outcome is very debilitating, horrific diseases that people end up with when they get older, which they might not have had at all.
Yeah, so this article ends with the Senate saying that the study's conclusion is premature given the results of previous studies. However, in view of the use of, and then they're naming an antibiotic, further study here is perhaps futile. In other words, this particular population, you really can't even go back to in 4 to 6 years to see if there was the result pointed to in previous studies. And real quickly here, what we've seen, I think from probably several people, but in particular a Dr. Marcia Angel with Harvard University, who was a prior editor of the New England Journal of Medicine for 20 years, and she went public in 2008 saying we could no longer trust the medical literature and medical authorities because it's not driven by science, it's driven by profits. And you can have a long list of bad studies, but if there's one good study, it's the good study that gets published and not the bad studies, for example. Well, here are some people writing an article saying, we can't trust this study. It's really not a good study, and it's even raised serious ethical concerns. It may actually be causing harm to the community that was the subject of the study. But what's going to get published and widely disseminated most likely is going to be the results of the study that says, oh, here, this, you know, particular vaccine that we tested on adults doesn't cause strain changes, so this is a good vaccine to use. And that would make it some widespread use.
Okay. Well, our time is up. We're going to hang in there for next week and continue with the latest news on vaccines and your rights and your health. So we're going to say bye-bye, Alan, and we're going to be on in a minute with Dr. Shambro talking about homeopathy and pet health.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, Debbie. Look forward to seeing you next week.
And your rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brock. On Homeopathy World Community Radio, remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Allow our souls.